For the week of June 23rd, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 196, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York and in the nude, I'm Michael Gill.
Wow. Okay. I guess you not only have
this. It's 90 degrees here.
Okay.
It is so hot. The humidity is 200%.
Okay.
And people don't realize this, but when we record the show, I have to turn off my air conditioner. I have to turn off the fans. It is hot. It's hot here.
Okay. So when we argue about stories for the first hour before we actually start recording,
yes,
then it probably doesn't do you any good because now the air conditioner has been off for an hour.
That's right. That's actually true. Absolutely. Don't worry, though. I am in peak physical condition.
Well, now, speaking of physical conditions, you know, I noticed just as we started the show, we went through all these stories, argued about, every single one of them. And then, one thing we didn't include was James Gandolfini, the death of James Gandolfini. I guess there's not really much to say other than it's really sad.
Of course. Yeah, it's sad.
I was really shocked to see so many people talking about, they seem to be so affected by it.
You mean fans around your town or do you mean celebrities? Online celebrity? I mean, it's just people, it's so much easier to comment now. You can see 10,000 comments and there's just, it's The Sopranos. ESPN had coverage of they talked about James Gandolfini dying. That tells you the audience for The Sopranos. It's everybody, even guys watching basketball. They care about The Sopranos and James Gandolfini. So it was just a show that loomed large for a lot of people, even beyond its initial audience. And, he died relatively young and unexpectedly. So that sort of brings, it's a little bit of a shock.
I know Bruce Springsteen, I guess, of course,
dedicated a song. Yeah,
he dedicated the whole album to him and then he played the whole album through.
Well, he's been doing that. He's been playing full albums at a lot of his shows. He didn't decide to do that in honor of him. He just, what was already planned to be done, he dedicated it to him.
Okay. Well, of course, Steven Van Zandt plays guitar and he was in the show.
That's right. Exactly.
But, another show that looms large is ours. Long past its, what did you say? A show that looms large long past its prime?
No, I didn't say that, but okay, keep going.
Before we even start, I guess I should say, hey, follow us on Twitter. We're at Showbiz Sandbox is our username. And on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. You can also email us, dirt@ShowbizSandbox.com is our email address. And you can call us, our toll-free number, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And sometimes we play the voicemails and read the emails that we get, and we appreciate all the correspondence that we receive. But on today's show,
before you tell them about today's show, tell them about the next 2 weeks. And everybody who wants to comment, you can yell at Sperling because it's his fault. Yeah. No show for the next 2 weeks. Sperling is going on a cruise.
Yes, I'm going on a cruise. So there will be no show for the next 2 weeks.
That's right. In 2 weeks. That means the next show will be July 15th or the week of July 14th, I guess.
No. Will it? Is it that long?
Well, next week is the first. It's the week of June 30th.
This is incredibly entertaining to our
listeners. The following week is the week of July 7th, which means the next show will be for the week of July 14th.
That's
which means
correct.
The Lone Ranger will have opened up, Despicable Me 2, Pacific Rim will have opened up, Grown Ups 2, all these movies, all these summer films will have already opened up because Sperling had to go on a cruise.
Okay, well, when you put it that way, let me call John Oliver and see if he's available to sub for me.
Well, he may be looking for work after the job he's doing, but anyway.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Snap!
Okay, well, as I was about to say, what we're going to be talking about on today's show is why some theaters are charging Michael nearly $50 for movie tickets. And that may not even be for the IMAX or 3D versions. The good news. Yep, that's right. I mean, the good news here is that theater owners and studios are finally working together. The bad news, of course, is that the U.S. government may not want theater owners and studios working together due to antitrust issues. Now, speaking of antitrust, it's always great to start a sentence that way. Speaking of antitrust, the Justice Department's case against Apple over the fixing of ebook prices has finally wrapped up, and we'll review who came out on top. Well, at least before the judgments are handed down. We're going to be talking about cord cutting, who's doing it, who's not doing it, who never had to because they never subscribed to cable in the first place, yet still managed to steal Netflix and HBO Go. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. This is the weekend box office around the world, not just North America, not just New York City. not just Canada, every film theater around the world. And the number one movie is Monsters University, a sequel to Monsters, Inc., another Pixar blockbuster. It grossed $137 million worldwide. It was the number one movie in North America with $82 million. It made another $55 million overseas. It's worldwide, $137 million, well on its way to another blockbuster movie, doing very big numbers. It's the biggest opening ever for a Pixar film, not named Toy Story 3. So, very good start for that franchise. At number two around the world is Man of Steel. That opened big in China. It's made $130 million worldwide this weekend. It's at $400 million and counting. It fell a little hard in North America, a little bit farther than some people expected. I'm starting to hear from fans who actually liked the movie. They said, oh, you're crazy. I had fun. I liked it. It was good. They sort of got a little bad buzz for hearing about it. And then they went to see it and they were happy. So, you know, $400 million and counting. Unquestionably a successful relaunch. We'll have to see how successful after another week or two.
It doesn't really matter because it didn't save the you know, head of Warner Brothers' job anyway.
That's right. And number three around the world is World War Z, the new Brad Pitt film. That made $112 million worldwide. It's Brad Pitt's biggest opening in North America, probably his biggest opening overseas as well. Not great reviews, not a hugely great cinema score from fans, meaning not fans aren't wildly enthusiastic about it, but they're already talking sequel. It was a solid, strong opening, and they're hoping that because it's an original film, it's not a sequel, it's not a whatever, they're hoping that they'll have a very good multiple, which means that when all is said and done, they started with $66 million in North America. They're hoping to make like $200 million, you know, when they're done. Because it's a new film. It's not a retread. So they weren't all necessarily there opening weekend.
Well, I think that there's a lot of people talking about how good the film is compared to what they had heard previously.
Fans were happy.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge article in Vanity Fair about how off the rails this film went and how, you know, Paramount was trying to save it and the story was horrible.
Well, they had a troubled production history and they had to reshoot the endings a couple times. But hey, that's what happened with Casablanca, too.
Exactly.
And Titanic. You never know. That production history stuff, I would never confuse that with commercial prospects. It's not a great sign.
No.
When everything sort of, you know, got to go back and do reshoots. But it hardly portends disaster. But the reviews were very poor.
Well,
not a well-reviewed film.
I still think in Titanic, they should not have sunk the boat.
That's right.
It was dead in the water after that.
Well, one franchise that is not dead in the water is Fast and Furious 6. That made $16 million around the world. Did you catch that? The first three films, $137 million, $130 million, $112 million. That's where all the money was. Way down at number four is Fast and Furious with only $16 million worldwide. So those first three movies, those are the monsters around the world. Fast and Furious is now at $666 million worldwide for Fast and Furious 6, proving that this franchise is the work of the devil.
Oh, 666.
I mean, come on.
I was like, how is he going to work in the 666 angle here?
At number five around the world is Now You See Me, the con magicians turned con artists. They're at $15 million worldwide. They're at $134 million in counting. In North America, they're about to cross the $100 million mark. So that's quite good for a movie that costs $80 million. It's not in profitability yet, but for the type of film it is, it's well on its way to being a success. At number six, far less questionable in its success, is After Earth, the Will Smith film, and Jaden Smith, I should say. It grossed $14 million. It's at $171 million and counting worldwide. It's in 74 markets. It's in more markets than any other film that's opened this week, so it's playing virtually everywhere. I don't know if it has any big market left like China or Japan, but it's falling fast everywhere it plays. Not a success story. A rare misstep for Will Smith, who's almost always been commercially successful.
Number seven. I mean, if I were working at Sony right now, I would be telling, if I was the head of Sony, I'd be telling the accounting department to get out the red ink pots because they're going to have to do some accounting.
But I would also be calling up Will Smith and saying, we love you. We respect you. We can't wait to make another movie with you. I would. I'd say,
okay,
you are a superstar. You are a success. We can't wait to do another project with you. You know, let's talk, because you want him to know that you value him, you appreciate him, and that you know that 9 times out of 10, he's going to deliver you a commercial hit. So if you're smart, people don't like a flop. That's when I would be on the phone with him more than ever to say, hey, baby, we love you. You're the best. At number seven is This Is the End. This is a fairly low budget film, $32 million, about the end of the world comedy, starring a bunch of pals in the sort of rising comedy troupe of, this is Seth Rogen and Michael Cera, and who else is in this? James Franco. They're all piling around having fun. It made $13 million. It's at $58 million worldwide. Great reviews. It's just starting to, it's still here in North America. That's it. It's about to double its budget and it's going to open up overseas. This is also, you know, you got to, do we care about reviews? Yes, because a movie like this is going to do great on DVD and, you know, in the home market because people really like it. They want to see it again. That makes it a lot more valuable than something that, you know, they see opening weekend and are bored by, like The Hangover 3. That's at number 8. It made $9 million. It's at $325 million worldwide. Again, the budget's a reported $110 million. It's tripling that. So it's a commercial success. But people, it's probably not going to do as well on DVD because people hated it. So, I mean, I really have not met anyone who didn't hate this movie. I mean, people just despise it, how bad it was. And I'm talking casual fans who don't care about critics. They hated this movie. At number 9, more mixed reaction was for Star Trek Into Darkness. That's winding down, though it probably has some other big territories to come. I'm not sure. It made $8 million. It's at $430 million and counting. And number 10 is the Google love fest called The Internship. That made $6 million. It's at $48 million and counting. That's tied with Despicable Me 2. That made $6 million overseas in one market. I believe it was the UK, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, probably.
It opened up the same weekend as Monsters University, and it made almost double what Monsters University made in that market. So it's just one market. It's just overseas, but it's the second film in a franchise. And it looks like it could be a real monster when it opens up in North America and the rest of the world. So good early notices for Despicable Me 2. Of course, if you listen to our show, you'll have to wait 3 weeks to find out.
Oh, my goodness.
Sperling is going on a cruise.
Well, wait a second. I thought you were doing something there. You said it's a monster of a hit because...
Oh, that was a little play on Monsters Universe.
Okay. Well, you know, I've always said Minions trump monsters every time.
Great Gatsby's at $313 million. Epic has quite slowed down. This is the Fox animated film. It's at $225 million and counting. I'm not sure what big markets it has left, but it's you know, it's not a hit. It's not a flop. It's not doing great. It's not doing terrible. And then well down below, The Purge is still at $68 million worldwide. That's the horror flick starring Ethan Hawke. And that Korean film, that comedy drama, Secretly Greatly, made another $3.7 million. It's at $37 million and counting.
Wow. Well, I guess the big news is Monsters, Inc., Superman, and World War Z, which is Brad Pitt's biggest opening. It surpassed the $50 million brought in by Mr. and Mrs. Smith back in 2005, which, of course, everybody remembers more for the fact that Brad Pitt met Angelina Jolie on that film than anything else.
Is that where they met?
That is where they met.
I thought I brought them together. I didn't know that. Well, I suppose we can pencil in a World War Z sequel for June, blah, 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 of 2015. Sounds about right.
That's right. And I, frankly, I don't even know how you have a sequel to the zombie apocalypse, frankly. I mean, once you've destroyed the planet once, how do you re-destroy it? In any case, you're right about that, because as the LA Times and numerous other media outlets have pointed out, all of these studios are saying, hey, let's schedule all of our films, or as they say in the biz, let's date all of our films all the way out to 2018.
Let's plant our flag. What they do, we talked about, was it last week or the week before, about Disney, and we listed the movies that they have mapped out. You know, every 2 months, they've got 2 or 3 years for the next 4 years, and they mapped out all their movies, their Pixar films, their Disney films, and they said, this is coming out this weekend. This is coming out June of 2016. This is coming out on this date in 2017. They mapped it out, and it's apparently a big trend for all of Hollywood.
Yeah, they have a huge franchise in the pipeline called Untitled, apparently.
that's everywhere. Everybody's got a piece of that one.
Yeah, apparently Disney
But tell
animation.
Us some of the other movies that we already know.
Well, okay, so, you know, all these studios are beginning to announce. We have the next Spider-Man movie arriving on May 2nd of next year.
My birthday.
Oh, happy
Everybody,
birthday.
Everybody, meet me at the theater for Spider-Man on my birthday. I'll see you there.
And then
I'll be wearing clothes, don't worry.
Oh. Well, if you're not, then you'll fit right in with Planet of the Apes, the spinoff, on May 23rd.
Well, no, they'll wear clothes by then, I think.
Well, that's true. So May 23rd, and then they're going to jump over to 21 Jump Street, the sequel for 21 Jump Street and How to Train Your Dragon and Transformers, which will be debuting throughout the rest of June 13th, 20th, and 27th.
I did not expect a sequel to 21 Jump Street.
I did not either.
But 20th Century Fox doesn't just have a release date for How to Train Your Dragon Part 2. It also has a release date for How to Train Your Dragon Part 3.
That's right.
In 2016. That's coming out, mark your calendars, June 16th of 2016. Do you love the Angry Birds? That's coming out July 1st of 2016. Do you like, oh my God, I mean,
Spanish Bulls? Ferdinand.
Is that the bull?
I have no idea what that's about, but
Well, Ferdinand the Bull is one of my favorite children's book. I don't think it should be a feature film. He's a gentle bull. He sits in a field. He likes to smell flowers. I don't think it's a feature-length film. Maybe a 20-minute TV special. But anyway, that's what they're doing. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's kind of a silly thing. It's like, you know, I don't know why they're going public with this information. It's pretty much known throughout the industry anyway when some of these films are opening. And the reason you go public with it is so that people, you know, other studios will know and they'll steer clear of certain weekends and give you the weekend.
It's the same way when they announce a sequel before a movie's opened, right? Or they announce a show gets a full season pickup before the pilot airs. They want to say, hey, we're really proud of this. We're really behind it. You want to see the next How to Train Your Dragon because it's so good. There's going to be a third one.
Yeah,
you know, it makes it seem like it's part of an exciting deal.
Right. And I think that, frankly, this is a sign of the corporatization of the motion picture industry. They're looking at these films and these franchises and these tentpole movies as products. And so they're saying, OK, we need, you know, a release of version one on date X and we need a release of version two on date Y. It, you know, Apple does the same thing with its products.
But Apple doesn't. They do not let you know until they are ready to announce, until it is ready to go. They don't say a word.
Right. No, but I mean,
we don't know when the next. You can guess. We can plead. We can believe. We can hint. But in fact, Apple waits until their product is absolutely ready, and then they have the announcement, and then they tell you when it's coming out.
Right. And most manufacturers tend to do that. What Apple does in this case.
Right. So that's very different. So they want to pretend that a movie is this, you know, regular thing that they can just churn out, but it's not true. It doesn't really matter. They're getting silly. They've reached the wall. They can't go more than, for God's sakes, 5 years in advance. It's 2013. So they're talking to us about what's going to happen in 2018. That's just silly.
Well, you can tell that like all of these studios, they have their, you know, they're all public and they must have their fiscal year end in June because, you know, they're all like, what's your 5-year plan? What are your 5-year financials for the next? And so they all know now what their next 5 years look like because they had to submit that earlier this week.
Well, none of it matters as long as they're willing to be flexible. They can plant their flag for Spider-Man 4 and that's fine. But they have to be able to accommodate and not worry about sticking to the release date. And I think they've shown that. So as long as they're flexible and say, all right, it's not working out, we're going to move it. And other people move stuff in, they move stuff out. You know, it's all written
in. Well, that's World War Z. I think that's the big story behind World War Z is that they pushed that film from Christmas of 2012 to summer of 2013. And everybody was raised, you know, had their eyebrows were flying off their faces. That's how raised they were. And what World War Z proved was no, if you just take a beat, try and fix the film and try and actually make a good film, getting pushed back or, you know, moving a
doesn't matter
because you're just trying to get a good movie, period.
That's right. Now, when you went to see World War Z, assuming you did you, how much did you pay for your ticket? You could have paid $50 if you wanted to.
I could.
What? Why would you want to pay $50 to see any movie?
Well, we told you last week about a deal between, what was it, Walmart and the premiere of Man of Steel, and fans who paid for a Blu-ray DVD combo pack, sight unseen, they hadn't seen the movie yet, they got a free ticket to a 7 p.m. screening hours before the movie officially opened later that evening. Apparently, that idea of getting people to fork over for a DVD before they've seen the movie, in exchange for seeing the movie early, it's beginning to spread in a way where studios and theater chains, theater owners, are working together.
Tell me, talk to me.
Well, I guess, you know, there's always, you know, theater owners and theater operators have always been at loggerheads with studios over windowing, right?
Yeah.
How soon after a movie is released in theaters does it premiere on DVD and Blu-ray and for download? World War Z had this similar deal kind of like Walmart.
But it had nothing to do with windowing.
No, had nothing to do with windowing. Nothing.
Okay. So what was the $50 ticket? What did it get you?
This consortium of studios worked together with Cineplex Entertainment in Canada, and that is important. And they call this thing a super ticket for $50, that if you buy this super ticket, you get to see the movie 2 days before its premiere, as well as...
$50. No, you're messing it up. That's different. World War Z has nothing to do with the Canadian thing. It's just that one movie. It's different. Nothing to do with the Canadian thing.
I thought that was the Canadian
thing.
Well,
it's way down in that story, but it's a different issue. World War Z, you pay $50, you got the poster, you got the thing. The Canada thing is just, do you want to download? We can charge you an extra $20, we give you a voucher, and when the download is available, you get to download it, period. That's it. That's all they offer in Canada.
Okay, well, that's what I'm referring to.
Well, the article later mentioned another thing more like Man of Steel. Well, you buy the ticket, you get to see the movie in advance. That, to me, is a bigger deal than... Want to buy the download? Here's a voucher. Big deal. Who cares? The other thing is more important. It's more of a, hey, you see the movie early, you see it before everybody else. We give you popcorn, we give you glasses, you get a poster. And, you know, and of course, when the download's available, you get to download it. In Canada, this thing with the owners in the theater, it's just this casual, we'll put an extra $20 in your credit card and you get a voucher. And when the download's available, you get it.
Pretty much, yes.
That's it.
But it's in conjunction with the studios. So the
theater
owners
are doing
this. Right,
World War Z is not.
Right. Okay. I mean, you threw this thing in there and it completely threw me off. So
I'm sorry. Right. So there's a couple things going on. Some studios are doing advanced screenings of movies where they charge you a big price and give you extra stuff. Like maybe you commit to buying the DVD combo pack, or maybe you get a 2-day advanced screening of the movie and you get glasses and a poster. That's what happened with World War Z. You got buttered popcorn.
Right.
You got a download digital copy of the movie when it becomes available to the general public. That's four, 5 months in advance. You get a voucher. You
right.
get special 3D glasses. You got a poster. That's what you got for your $50 to see World War Z. In Canada, they're doing something a little different. When you go see a movie, there's now a consortium between a major chain or more than one chain and
well, no,
the studio.
No, it's just Cineplex Entertainment, which is
all
the
right.
largest chain
Their
in
largest
Canada.
Their largest chain in Canada. And when you go see a movie, perhaps any movie, I don't know, or maybe it's just particular movies, they say, hey, you want to pay an extra $20? If you do, we'll give you a digital voucher so that when it's available as a digital download, 3 or 4 or 5 months in advance, whenever that might be, you will have already paid for it.
Right.
That's all it is.
Now, this is in conjunction with a multi-studio deal, the first of its kind, with Warner Brothers, Paramount Pictures Canada, Sony Pictures, and Universal Pictures. They all partnered with Cineplex Entertainment in Canada. And they, you know, they're also, by the way, the studios behind Ultraviolet. So they participate in Ultraviolet, which is how you will get this digital download.
Now, no, that doesn't matter. It's just the website you go to
right,
get the
right.
download. Yeah. In other words, they're saying, hey, do you want to buy the DVD before you've seen the movie? Step right up.
Right.
But unlike Man of Steel and World War Z, they don't offer you anything for that. All you're doing is committing to buying a copy of the movie for your home use before you've seen it.
Well, they might
say,
you
don't get a discount. You don't get it in advance of anybody else. You don't get anything. You just get to hand over more money for the movie that you're about to see. To me, it's bizarre. Why go to all that trouble? I mean, they're not getting a discount. They're not getting any special treatment. What's the point? Why would anybody pay an extra $20 for a digital download of a movie they haven't seen yet?
Yeah, I don't know. And quite honestly, the reason that they did this, there's a couple points here. One, studios realize they want to move up the release of the home video closer to films. How do they do that when theater owners are...
Make them part of the system.
Make them part.
If they get a cut, assuming the chain, and they must get a cut of that $20, otherwise, why would they bother?
Right.
That means they get to get somehow a slice of the pie for home entertainment. Now, suddenly, they're getting a little piece of home entertainment. I don't know why they'd want to give up a piece of that when they don't have to. But if they do, then in exchange, they think they're not going to mind if you move up the home entertainment release date another 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Is that going to give you that much more money that it's going to be so much more profitable that you don't mind giving 1% away to the theater owners?
Well, I think you just proved that probably not. No. And it's an experiment. You know, it's a beta program, a pilot program here that they're trying. Now, why did they do this in Canada instead of the U.S.?
Because they don't want to be sued?
Right. Because, well, when all of a sudden you have four studios working together, that's already anti-competitive. I mean, there's only six studios to begin with. So you have four studios, a majority of the studios working together in conjunction. So they're the manufacturers right there. They're manufacturing the content. Then you have the distributor of the content, or, you know, in this case, the movie theaters, the exhibitor, the sales channel also participating and kind of colluding, if you will, with these studios.
Well, but I mean, Canada doesn't like monopolies either.
Right,
they
but it's a little bit
Canada.
It's a little bit easier to do this pilot
the
program.
The liberal, beautiful Northern Canada is somehow more conservative and willing to let businesses run amok?
No. I'm just saying, you know what? You're going to do a pilot program like this? Do it out of town.
But it's in Canada.
Yeah.
They don't like big evil companies. They're actually more proactive. They're like, hey, be nice.
Hey, it wasn't Paramount Pictures. It was Paramount Pictures Canada that participated.
I understand.
Okay, there's a
All
reason
right.
for that.
Well, Canada's not looking the other way as they act like monopolies.
No, but I think Canada is a little bit more lenient.
I don't think Canada is more business friendly than America.
No, not at all. I think it's just a matter of, you know what, we'll see how this program goes. If it doesn't take off, then...
And I think it's stupid. Why? You know, I understand the advanced screening thing. I wouldn't pay $50 just to get to see World War Z 2 days ahead of my friends. you know, I want to see the movie before I decide I'm excited enough to own a copy of it in my home. But at least you're getting something. You get to see it early. They give you the other merchandise. That I get. Paying, committing to a digital download 4 months before it comes out? Why?
Well, let's just review one thing that you said. You said, I don't know why the studios would want to give up that money for the digital download. They'd probably be giving up some portion of that money anyway to sell.
Not to the theater chains.
Not to the theater chains, but whoever they're selling the digital download through, whatever channel that is, would probably get that money anyway, a certain percentage anyway. So in this case, instead of it being Hulu or whatever, or iTunes.
It's their own website.
Yeah, they're just saying, hey, you know what? Okay, so we would have made the wholesale value anyway. We'll still make that wholesale value, which is all we want for right now anyway, and we'll do it through the theater owners, let them keep the retail value.
So it's a way of locking out the retailer. To heck with Amazon, speaking of monopolies. All right, well, that makes sense to me a little bit more. But anyway, moving on to television.
Right.
I don't want to go to theaters. I just want to see movies at home.
Well, you know, speaking of monopolies, here we have a story about Time Warner Cable being sued for passing the cost of purchasing the Dodgers. Well, I guess they didn't purchase the Dodgers, but
the TV rights and stuff. It's their sports rights deals. They're multi-billion-dollar deals to get sports programming.
Multi-billion-dollar deals and multi-decade-long deals. So I guess last year they purchased the rights to the Dodgers, and that launches in 2014, that deal. And
that was $8 billion.
$8 billion deal. And they paid $3 billion to the Lakers for the next 20 years of television rights. And for the Dodgers, it was 25 years. So maybe that's why it was a little extra.
But, and who's going to pay? Who's going to pay for that?
Well, that's $11 billion. Okay, so let me just, if you did the math on that. Yeah, we will.
That's right.
I'm a Time Warner customer. You're a Time Warner customer.
Your cable bill is going up.
We have no choice. We could not call AT&T UVerse and say, please come and install your cable here. At least I can't. Maybe you can. I know I can't. I can't call
Verizon.
Well,
my deal in New York's not going to go up, right? I mean, I'm not in California. I'm not watching the Dodgers or the Lakers. They're not even going to be available to me.
No, your deal in New York won't go
up. Right. They're going to be paying in California for this $11 billion.
Right. But apparently, four Time Warner customers decided to file a class action lawsuit in L.A. Superior Court last week, and they're seeking restitution and injunctive relief for violating California's Business and Professions Code 172,000. That's the code, 172,000.
Right. And it's not important a code. It's just a generic code that a lot of people use to say, hey, that's an unfair business practice.
Pretty much.
What is their argument? What is their claim? They're saying basically, quote, in sum, Time Warner Cable will extract from its customer base, primarily in Southern California, at least $11 billion to recoup its investment. And approximately 60% of this amount, or $6.6 billion, is coming from people who don't want it and don't want to watch it and don't want to pay for Lakers and Dodgers telecasts, and who, if given the option, would opt out.
That's right.
And they're saying that's not right. And it just upended the entire cable business.
Right. Now, I think, actually, when it comes to sports like this, I don't mind bundling so much. But I do mind when these companies, be it the Dodgers, the Lakers, in this case, Time Warner Cable, they are profiting. I mean, think about it. In 2002, 2003, they sold the Dodgers for $400, $500 million. Less than 10 years later, they sold it for $2.7 billion or something like that. You're telling me the value of that franchise, a franchise that did not win the World Series, a franchise that had not been playing very well.
Because they had their TV channel. That's why. It's like the Yankees have $1 billion TV channel on the YES Network.
The Lakers did not have a TV channel and still don't. And they're playing even worse this year than they have in the past.
Right. So, well, you're off topic.
Okay.
These people are suing the cable company. Are they going to succeed?
I think this might be the test case. This very well may be a test case to say, hey, you know what? You can go out and you can't go out and pay these enormous amounts expecting that people who don't want the product.
They don't have to take your cable channel then.
Right.
They don't have to take your cable business. They can go somewhere else, except it's a monopoly. But it won't go federal because it's a state law.
That's right. That is correct.
Right. It may have certain repercussions, but I don't know. It sounds iffy to me. It's like they don't want to pay for sports. Somebody else doesn't want to pay for headline news. Somebody else says, I don't want to pay for Fox News. Somebody else says, I don't watch MTV. You know, then don't watch it. But here's my solution. If I'm a cable company, and of course, this is complicated because the cable company is paying for the sports programming. It's not ESPN saying we want a $6 per customer charge. But when you've got a company like ESPN saying, hey, we want to up the amount of money we get for each person that's on your cable channel, I say, why don't you just become an HBO premium channel? Let them opt in for you. Why not just take it out of your hands and say, you know what? You're no longer, you know, on a tier, whatever. You're just a service. If they want to buy you, they can buy you, like HBO and Showtime. If they don't want to buy you, they don't have to. There's boxing on Saturday night on pay-per-view, $50, $70. A lot of people buy it. You know what? I've never bought it, but I don't have to pay for it because it's pay-per-view.
Right, so it's like a grocery
store.
That's
why it's $50. Yeah. That's why it's $70. If it was on HBO, then you'd be paying $12 a month. If it was on basic cable, whatever, a channel that I had to carry, then it would be part of my package, and we'd all be paying an extra $2 a month to have boxing on cable when we don't ever want to watch it. I'm never going to watch a boxing match. That's why it's on pay-per-view. So why don't you go to ESPN and say, never mind. We're going to make you a premium channel. If they want to buy ESPN, you can bundle it any way you want. You charge whatever you want. Knock yourselves out. You want to charge $10 for all five of your channels? See how many people take it. You're on your own, buddy. And none of your customers would be angry at you. I'm not going to be angry at Time Warner Cable if I find out ESPN is now a premium channel. And if I want it, I got to pay $10. That's my choice.
That's right.
Right? So for all those big channels that are trying to up and up and up how much they charge per head, make them a premium channel. Say, hey, you know what? You knock yourself. Do whatever you want. Charge as much as you want. See if the customer's willing to pay. Have a nice day. Suddenly, my $162 cable bill, which includes relatively basic cable, one DVR box, one tier so I can watch the Big Ten Network because I like gymnastics, and it has internet, which sucks. I have no telephone. It's just cable and Wi-Fi, crappy Wi-Fi. And I pay $162 a month because of this monopoly. You knock that down to $110 and let me decide whether or not I want to buy ESPN. Now you're talking.
Right. And I guess ultimately what you're saying is, hey, turn cable into a department store where people place their products.
No, no. I think a lot of channels would be smart and say, I want to be on basic cable. I want to be part of that service. I want to keep my fees reasonable because I want to reach as many people as possible. I don't think IFC and Sundance, I would never have seen Rectify, one of the best shows of the year, if Sundance was a premium channel and I had to pay to access it.
I agree.
I would be watching Wilfred on FX. Or Archer, if I had to step in and call them up and pay for that channel as a premium service every month when I only want to watch Archer twice a year, I wouldn't do it. So they would realize the value of being on a basic cable system. But for those special channels like ESPN and certain others, they want to charge premium prices, make yourself a premium channel. Then suddenly Time Warner doesn't have the headache.
Well, that seems somewhat, it seems somewhat innovative, really.
Yeah, it's sort of a combination between the argument to everybody gets to go a la carte and making basic tier as broad and accessible to as many channels as possible.
Well, I was mentioning that word innovative because Raul Buril submitted a story here via Facebook that...
Raul Buril?
Yes.
Okay.
A listener. And he submitted this story via Facebook about how cable giants are embracing innovation to battle cord cutting. And this was a story written by Julia Borstein of CNBC, who was also the moderator of the George Lucas... Steven Spielberg event that we spoke about last
week. Where they opined on the movie industry.
Yes, where the movie industry is imploding.
It's
going to
end. It's going to implode. It's going to die. Run, run.
If I were an event planner or one of these people producing these events, I would not invite Julia Borstein to moderate my event because last week it was, Lucas and Spielberg talking about...
What did she do wrong?
Well, now she moderates this other event. Or reports on this other event, and Craig Moffett, this industry analyst, is talking about how, people are cutting the cords and how the percentage of Americans who pay for TV will drop from 88% to 82% by the year 2020. It's like, oh my goodness, now we have cable is imploding. Julia, please, don't leave the house.
Oh, she's doom and gloom. She's the storm crow of...
exactly.
Okay, I get it. So it's not you're saying she did a poor job.
No, not at all.
No, okay, very good. Okay, I've never seen her host. I'm sure she does a great job.
No, I'm
so
I'm making
she says,
light
oh my God,
it, yeah.
Cable's imploding. People are cutting the cord more than ever.
Right. Well, it was Craig Moffett that was saying that. And he's
right.
Often quoted as, this, cable industry guy. And he says, quote, that cable distributors, and this is true, they have very little ability to push back on the escalation of their costs. And this is what we were just talking about. But they're hearing from their end users that prices are increasing way too fast and that they're between a rock and a hard place. And that's what Craig Moffett had to say. And I would agree with that.
And the solution is to innovate.
Yes.
So tell me, what innovations have they done? What have they come up with? How are they going to innovate?
They came up with,
I say innovate by cutting my costs in half, but what are they going to do?
They came up with, they've read a lot of magazine articles on what they should probably be doing to innovate. Because if you listen to Cox Communications president, Pat Esser, he says, and this is a quote, cord cutting is real. Consumer behavior is shifting and they want their entertainment where they want it and when they want it and on the devices they want it on. And to that I say, wow, you must be reading Wired magazine for the first time, because that's been said for the past like 2 years. And so,
TV anywhere.
Yeah. I'm like, really? Are you literally spouting the same?
But they haven't done it yet. Most people cannot watch TV on their iPad or their iPhone or their laptop if they're not sitting in their home. Right. And most of them can't even do that there.
And then you had Comcast CEO Brian Roberts unveiling this new user interface that I guess they've dubbed X2, and it's got voice control remotes and intelligent user interaction. And he says, it all starts with our goal, which is to take all of the intelligence out of the cable box and put it in the cloud. That allows us to innovate faster. It's smarter, it's personalized, it's easy, it's fun, and it's beautiful. And I thought, oh my gosh, these two guys have been literally like trained by their PR team to say all of these things, because 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they would have sued anybody out of existence who was putting this stuff in the cloud.
So there's nothing. Did they have any examples of any innovation by anyone?
Well, this X2 stuff, but no, they had nothing. They had a lot of catchphrases. They did have lots of catchphrases, lots of jargon.
Okay, well, Julia Borstein is perhaps not destroying the cable industry all alone. That they're doing a good job on their own. But so prices are going to remain high, but you're going to have a remote that you can activate by your voice.
Yes, which is exactly what I want when I, you know, yeah. No, it's not what I want. In fact, there are some people that aren't using remotes at all. Most of them are in college.
Most cord cutters are college students?
That's right. Well,
but I mean,
no.
they haven't cut the cord because they haven't started yet having their own home where they have cable.
Right. And actually, that's what I would like to say, is that most of the people in college don't have cable yet, and they may never have cable because they're so used to not having it. So it's just one of those lifestyle.
They grew up with it. They had it in their homes as children.
And that's exactly what this article from the LA Times.
To not having it. They've had it all their lives.
Well, according to Sanford Bernstein, Todd Younger of Sanford Bernstein, which is a research firm, they did this study. And the study says the demands of college, both time and money, ultimately trump the need for the vast array of content choices a pay TV package can provide. This behavior is then carried forward beyond college, and the cord cutter is born. And to that I say, yeah, that's why we call them cord nevers.
Right. So they've learned that they don't need TV or a cable package in college.
Right.
Is that that's where they also learn to binge drink, take out loans to pay your rent, and sleep till noon.
That's right.
But you know, college ends and then you stop binge drinking, except on the weekends. You probably don't take out loans to pay your rent. You get a job. And you don't sleep till noon because you got a job. So now you've got an apartment or a home, and you probably want to watch television, and you possibly get a cable TV package.
Right. And one of the people quoted in the study said, well, maybe I'll get, you know, a cable connection when I start a family, when I'm a little older.
Right. Exactly. Though I must say, I do know, we've looked at the numbers. There's millions of people who have cut the cord or who've never had cable TV if they come out of college. And I have friends like that. I know a couple friends who do not have television. I'm like, well, what do? They just stream stuff on Netflix or here and there, and that's what they do. So it does happen. It's still not a huge number of people yet. It's still not a growing, the idea that 20% of all households will not have cable is a little bit high, I think.
Well, you know, right now, I mean,
or
you mentioned
some access to television.
You mentioned Netflix. You mentioned Netflix and you mentioned HBO. Well, you didn't mention HBO Go, but those are two services that college students are kind of sharing passwords and usernames for. They kind of steal it, if you will.
They learn to steal as well. Yeah, they're also pirating albums and books and movies. Yes.
Actually, they're saying they don't do that as much because it's much easier to just share the username and password to Spotify than it is to have to go and download stuff.
Right. And, I'm here in New York, and my friends have a farm upstate. They wanted to watch Yankee games at the farm upstate. Here's some innovation that we have via Time Warner Cable, the YES Network. Now lets you access Yankee games on two other devices at the same time, you know, during the game, as long as you're in New York State when you do it. You don't have to be in your home. You can be outside your home, or you can even be outside the city. As long as you're in New York State, you get to do it. However, they charge you for it.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got a $162 cable bill, and they're like, oh, you want to watch your Yankee game that you already pay for? You're gonna pay more money. And they can say, oh, but that's a second home. You're in a second. Like, yeah, they're there, you know, a couple hours. They got, you know, like five games they'll probably want to watch in a year when they're at the farm upstate. You know, they don't live there. They don't want to pay cable to have it, you know, 30 months out of the year when they're only there on the weekends for a day or two. and every other couple of weeks. So why are you charging for them? It should be something that they should happily provide because you're already paying $162. But instead of innovating and giving us a new service, they say, oh, here's another way to increase your bill. Thank you very much.
Well, it's the same thing with XM, Sirius XM Radio, where they say, thank you for subscribing, having two radios that you subscribe $12 a month for each one and actually going up. So it's like $15 a month for each one. Oh, did you want the internet streaming music as well?
Oh, my God. They charge you for the internet?
Oh, yes.
They charge you to go on your laptop and listen to Sirius XM?
Yes, indeed.
Sirius. Am I saying it right? Is it Sirius XM?
Yes, it is. Sirius XM Radio.
Wow. I thought that just came with it.
Same here. And no, they charge you for it.
They shouldn't charge you for it even if you just have one and you have two subscriptions and they want to charge you extra to not sit in your car and listen to it.
Correct.
Wow.
Yes, I said the same thing.
Oh my God. But, well,
you were mentioning ESPN earlier.
I love them.
Yeah, and how they could possibly make that a premium channel. Well, Jonathan Rogers submitted a story via Facebook about ESPN 3D.
This is great. We don't have to do work anymore. We can just let all our listeners submit all the stories.
Why do you think I moved the mentions up earlier about Facebook and Twitter and all that so that people would just tell us what they want us to cover?
Or they'll tell us stop going on vacation for 2 weeks a year, Sperling. They might do that.
Well, it's only 1 week, but by the time I get back, it won't be. Anyway, Jonathan Rogers submitted this lovely story about ESPN 3D shutting down via Facebook.
I love this. Tell me about it.
So apparently, well, not apparently, they did. In 2010, ESPN said, hey, we're going to have this 3D channel. We're going to show you the FIFA World Cup in 3D, the NBA Finals in 3D. We're going to show you X Games in 3D. And they did
that.
They
had about 3 hours a week of programming.
Yes, that was part of the problem, is that it was somewhat sporadic and nobody watched it. And, even though the number of televisions that were 3D capable continued to increase, nobody watched it. Did I mention nobody watched it? Because... Oh. That's really the problem, is that it gained no adoption at all. So they said, hey, you know what? We're going to close it down. Instead, right. They're going to focus on probably 4K broadcast, which, by the way, I got to tell you, 8K television, and I know that goes beyond 4K, but 8K television, that is really what I'm waiting for. That just looks stunning. It's like looking out a picture window.
It's like high def television was a massive leap forward. It really was. It's amazing. When I watch a baseball game, and then they show slow motion, you can see the ball spinning in the air and the seams on the detail of what you see. It looks like a film. So that's what we all say nowadays, right? When something's really cool, we say it's like a movie. But like the slow motion effect is so detailed and interesting, and the dirt flying up and the details of what you can see, their stance, the ball, it's unbelievable. And you're telling me that this is an astronomical leap over what I have right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you saw this, it really is. It's freaky.
Is it like 60, 48 frame rate per, is it like that in the movies?
I think it depends. It is a bit of an adjustment like that, but not nearly as much.
But it's just a lot more information, a lot more detail. They need new cameras, I take, to film it.
Well, you need 8K cameras. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Are they widespread now? Is it expensive? How hard is it going to be to get programming in 8K?
Well, let's see. The sets alone cost $25,000.
Well, no. That's for people in the home. I'm just talking about the industry to start. They can start shooting in 8K and show it to your TVs today, and it won't matter, right?
Yeah,
it's backwards compatible.
It's not widespread.
You won't see the advantages, but it will be fine.
They could, but not broadly. No, I mean mostly.
Why not?
Because they don't have 8K cameras. They have a limited.
If they shoot something in 8K, they can broadcast it today. It's backwards compatible.
Yes,
they can broadcast it on ESPN today. It doesn't matter that you don't have an 8K TV. You'll see it and it'll look great on your high-def television. It just won't look the way it will look on 8K.
I'm going to go with, first off, I'd have to look that up, but I believe that is the case, yes.
Okay, so why are they saying they'll likely focus on 4K if Sperling here is talking about 8K?
Because, that's Ultra HD, which is what 8K is called, and 4K, frankly. The 8K is just like way over the top. 4K is probably the next...
You promise
step.
Me it won't be 12K a year after that?
I can't promise that. I'm waiting for them to actually have holograms enter the home.
Okay, but we have been saying that 3D in the home is not a non-starter.
Right. That
it's not happening. People do not want to sit in their home with 3D glasses on for a 4-hour baseball game 80 times or 160 times a year. They don't want to sit there with their friends watching football and have bulky glasses on their head and have to take them off every 5 seconds to drink a beer, go into the kitchen, do this, do that, eat a hot dog. It's stupid. It's annoying. It doesn't work. It's not great. It's not happening.
Right. I mean, I think at the time when they announced this, we said that, look, this is not going to be a big deal.
Hey!
See that? See how I worked that in there? Because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment. We're going to tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, here's our first story, and how could it not be our first story? Robert Downey Jr. Both Disney and Robert Downey Jr. decided that, yes, indeed, they would, in fact, like to make piles and piles of money. So Downey Jr. has signed on for two more Avengers films, Avengers 2 and Avengers 3. Go figure. Disney asked, where would you like us to send the Brinks armored truck full of gold bars? And Downey said, oh, you know, any one of my mansions will do. The question is, what and how much did they pay him? And with all the other actors back for multiple spinoffs and more Avengers movies, how important are they and how much money do they get? You can be sure of one thing. None of them got any points.
Big Not deal again. Don't make that mistake.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop, Michael.
I just want to know, when is it coming out? I want to know the release date and I want to know it now. Of course, they probably have already announced it, but that's okay. So, yes, he's made the deal. They wanted him. It does not include Iron Man movies, so that's still up in the air. That's interesting, but hey, one of the most successful films of all time. There's no reason why he shouldn't want to be involved. They really want him. They see him as the signature person on that movie. You can imagine a different Thor. You can imagine a different Captain of America, I suppose. You know, those actors are fine. But you cannot imagine a different Robert Downey Jr., and they don't want to mess around with that. Hey, you can certainly imagine a different Incredible Hulk. My question, and it's one about, because Downey Jr. did have points on the movie, you know, the Avengers grossed $1.5 billion worldwide. Is it still in the red? Is it profitable? Have they actually made money in the accounting sense? That's what I'd like to know.
Probably not.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, here's my question. If 1 million records get sold and Billboard doesn't report it, did it actually happen?
That's not your question.
Yeah, it's not my question. In fact, it's the question that Jay-Z had, and he posted that question on Twitter. And he was really asking, frankly, whether the music industry has turned on him. He's the big rapper mogul, Jay-Z. This is who we're talking about here.
And
I would have to say, no, they're just sticking to their policy of not counting giveaway albums. Samsung and Jay-Z made a promotional deal. Fans who own Galaxy mobile phones can access a Jay-Z app, and after a few days of interacting with Jay-Z content, they'll be able to download a copy of his new album. Samsung will pay Jay-Z $5 for every album they give away. But Billboard says since nothing was actually for sale to fans, the free albums won't count as actual sales. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's a long-going policy. It makes sense. Nobody paid for it. Therefore, it's not a sale. Newspapers in England gave away copies of a Prince album. That doesn't count as a sale. I'm sorry. If it's given away, you didn't buy it. And by the way, Robert Downey Jr. was a big deal because, of course, it should happen. And you don't want to mess with a franchise that big. So that was a big deal. This is a big whoop.
Okay, well, here's something that apparently every news organization in the world seemed to think was a big deal. We'll see what you think. Celebrity chef Paula Deen, or as I like to say, the woman who cooks with Crisco. She is facing a firestorm of criticism and a threat to her business thanks to a discrimination suit brought against Deen and her company by a former employee. The woman says she was sexually harassed, dealt with racially discriminatory language, and mistreatment of employees was based on race, frankly. The woman is white, by the way. We should mention that. And she was forced to watch porn. That was also something that she alleged. She says Deen aided and encouraged this environment at restaurants she owned. Deen was her own worst enemy on the stand for the $15 million civil lawsuit, admitting, this is what she admitted, that she'd used the N-word in the past. She said, you know, when she was auditioning for Django
no,
and Chain.
No.
She said that her husband told jokes using the N-word.
She said, well, jokes involve Blacks and gays and Jews. What are you supposed to do?
Yeah, what do you call them? She longed to have a restaurant staffed solely by middle-aged Black men in white tuxedos for that plantation effect, but worried others might take it the wrong way and so on. Which way did you think we'd take it? That's what I want to know. Deen was scheduled to be interviewed by Matt Lauer on the Today Show, but backed out at the last minute. Can't imagine why. She released several video statements on YouTube begging for forgiveness for the mistakes she'd made. Later that day, the Food Network announced it would not be forgiving her or renewing Deen's contract, which is up at the end of June. Now Deen is back on Today, and Lauer, she's returning to the Today Show.
Well, she's not returning. She didn't appear.
Well, yeah, she's going to do the Today Show. And she's going to face the music and do some damage control. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. She's a very big fixture on the Food Network, though. It's interesting in a couple ways. One, how she said, why go on the Today Show and be grilled by Matt Lauer? I'm just going to go on YouTube where we can control it and I can make a statement and the whole world can see it. I thought that was sort of interesting and smart. I thought it would work. I think the big thing here is bad timing. Her deal was up at the end of June. They could have punted and delayed making the decision, let it all die down. I'm a little surprised how they acted that when they acted, I thought they'd her you know, contriteness would work for her and that they would just say, hey, she's made amends and she's going to do this and that. And, you know, we're going to move on. But they said, you know what, our bottom line, we don't need the hassle. Why do we want this bad publicity to hurt our brand of our channel? We're just going to step away from her.
Especially since literally all the food she cooks is like made with lard.
Well, she's got diabetes and
yeah,
and,
it's like,
you know, it's incredibly, well, it's they never claimed she was a healthy food person. So that's like, just a tasty food person, but she was her own worst enemy. They thought, gee, maybe we can deal with this on our own. Let's cut the media out as the middleman and do it on YouTube. It didn't help enough. And now she's saying, you know what? I need the stamp of approval of the media to try and get back again. She has restaurants. I'm sure she'll be back somewhere else. You know, she's been too popular too long. I doubt this will end her forever. I mean, Martha Stewart went to jail. She's still around. So it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. But, you know, she's a fool and her own worst enemy on the stand. But
right. No one ever said. So what you're saying is she's her own worst enemy in court and also in the kitchen.
That's right.
Well, in the wake of a Supreme Court ruling that acknowledged networks deserve fair warning about standards, the FCC is mulling changes to its indecency oversight over broadcast networks. Fox Broadcasting weighed in and said the FCC should get out of the business of network oversight given the changing times and technology. In fact, you should probably just close down and send all of your employees home because that's what they do. You know, come on.
Stupid regulations.
You know, the post office should get out of the business of delivering the mail.
No, they should, because then UPS would have to spend a lot more money and suddenly they'd find their profits hurting.
Right.
UPS, FedEx, DHL, they depend on us funding the post office. But anyway.
It says, you know, Fox says that rules are, you know, the FCC's rules are arbitrary and confusing, and except for the most extreme content, which, let's face it, graphic sex, excretory organs, and or activity, the FCC should stop bothering. No oversight on cursing, nudity, innuendo, etc. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. Not the fact that the Fox says, hey, get out of the business, but the fact that they might actually do it. And I think unless you're showing porn, unless, you know, they should not be trying to come up with one community standard for the entire country. It just doesn't work. And the era when you only had ABC and NBC and Fox, and those were your options, you've got 24-hour Christian channels. You've got 24-hour Nickelodeon. You've got 24-hour Skinemax. You can watch whatever you want, and you've got DVRs. You can control what your kids watch and when. You can skip over all the ads. You can preview them and then let your kids watch it. So the range of options for most people is so broad now that I think it really is an outdated system. It's silly. It's pointless. You know, her nipple appears on the Super Bowl. Families can be outraged at the network and say that, and they don't want that. U2 says a curse word on a Grammys, whatever, you know?
Well, you know, and Fox is saying, look, we can't compete with the type of entertainment and the type of programming that is over on cable channels because they have no...
Well, I don't care about Fox and I don't care about them wanting to be edgier, but I'm saying if you're a family and you want to make sure your kids are watching wholesome family entertainment, you have 8 million ways to do that. And you have channels you can watch and you can preview everything before your kid watches it. You're not a slave to what the network shows.
So your I see what you did there.
Descent to control, yeah. Your ability to control what your kids watch and make sure it's appropriate for them is so much stronger now that the power is in your hands. And you know what? If you don't like what Fox shows and you don't like Family Guy, I wouldn't want my little kids watching Family Guy. I don't need the FCC to tell me that.
Well, okay. I like what you did, though, by intermingling the two stories, Paula Deen and the FCC.
Thank you very much. I'm also eating butter.
Okay. Well, and what was the name of that network you mentioned, Skinemax? What channel is that on?
Keep going.
Okay. Former movie producer, big-time media mogul, and once and future kingmaker of Italian politics, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has received his third jail term in the past year. So I guess the guy...
He's on a roll.
He's collecting jail terms. This time he faced charges of paying a minor for sex, speaking of Skinemax, and more significantly, using his power as then prime minister to cover it up, because if you can't cover it up, why bother being prime minister? The 76-year-old Berlusconi was sentenced to 7 years in jail and a lifetime ban from politics, which will be, how do they measure lifetimes in Italy? Because he's received the same punishment numerous times, and yet he always manages to become the prime minister. In any case, last October, he was sentenced to 4 years for tax evasion, and in December, he got 1 year for wiretapping via a newspaper run by his younger brother. And people said, look, we're going to discount that one because you're no Rupert Murdoch. In any case, all the cases are being appealed, and his lawyers say it's all a big misunderstanding. Of course they do. Berlusconi and the Egyptian-born exotic dancer, Karima El... I'm not even going to try and pronounce that. But she's best known by her stage name, Ruby the Heart Stealer. His lawyers say they never had sex. Are we allowed to say that on a podcast? I guess we are.
Sure, sure. The FCC Kids, cover your ears.
Yeah.
Never listen to Berlusconi.
Right. Berlusconi never gave her $6 million as a gift, and the few thousand dollars he admits to giving her on several occasions were just sweet examples of him being, quote-unquote, humane towards a young woman with financial difficulties. Hey, I have financial difficulties too, Mr. Berlusconi. Can you, throw some money my way? Or am I the wrong gender? In any case, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, he's the big power player in the country. He's going to be in jail. It's like Rupert Murdoch going to jail. He was a big player in Hollywood, and I would not have bought a used car from him. He was shady 40 years ago, 30 years ago in Hollywood with his dealing and wheeling. It's like the guys from Canon Film suddenly becoming, the prime minister of Israel. It's crazy that he ever became president or prime minister of that country. And It's just mind-blowing. And I love this, he's just trying to be humane towards a young woman. Last time I tried to be humane towards a young woman, I got slapped. But anyway, I think it's significant. I bet the fact that he got a year for the wiretapping because of a newspaper that his brother ran, I bet that caught the attention of Rupert Murdoch. But, he's a big player. I'm not sure what a lifetime ban means from politics. Does that mean he can't hold office? Does it mean he can't fund campaigns or be an advisor? What does it mean? I don't know, but he's going to jail. I don't think he can get all three overturned. And he's 76 years old, so that's pretty significant.
Yeah, well, maybe he'll be there with that Amanda Knox character. Or maybe he's saying...
Oh, God. Why is he going to be in jail?
I'm just saying, I'm sure he's wondering, how come the American can get off and I can't?
Because she's innocent, perhaps?
Possibly. Now, let's talk about Jimmy Kimmel. He wants to be the late-night host of the future. So he's doing everything he can in the present to build his brand. That includes copying the Today Show and Good Morning America, both of which have outdoor concert venues, so big acts can do songs in front of a large, adoring crowd, rather than, say, studio audiences that barely clap their hands and can't even see the band because the cameras are in the way. The newly rebranded MySpace approves, and they've just made a deal to live stream those sets on their site. The site is backed in part by Justin Timberlake. So does this mean Justin Timberlake needs his hip appeal of Jimmy Kimmel for his new business? I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. They're live streaming some concerts from the Jimmy Kimmel Show. They were already available online. Now they're on MySpace. Big deal. I mean, big whoop. Oh my God, I messed it up.
Okay. Well, I think, part of what was interesting to me about this story is that they were going to, you might show one or two songs during the late night talk show.
All do that, though. They all say, go to the web, you can see another song or two. Sure, they all do that. It's not going to be a two-hour show. I've never gone. Jon Stewart says, I got the rest of the interview online. Go check it out. I'm like, no, thank you. Yeah, if you didn't put it on the air, I don't have time.
Yeah, the fulfillment on that is probably pretty slim.
Yeah.
Well, Microsoft has, apparently, made a retreat from the disastrous security measures it installed in the new Xbox One gaming system. After an initial online connection to set the system up, you will never have to go online again to play any games. No need for a connection every 24 hours to establish that you are actually you. It probably didn't help that soldiers in the military were writing outraged comments about how Microsoft was making life hell for troops overseas. They didn't stop there. Microsoft also said it was abandoning all the restrictions on loans and reselling of games, the reselling of used games. They won't allow retailers to restrict your legal right to loan or give away or sell your used video games, and they won't make the games useless if you don't sell them to an approved retailer.
In other words, they're following the law. Thank you.
So will Sony follow suit? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, It's a big deal. They really, you know, retracted what they did. As some people said, what was that show we were listening to, the podcast?
Yes, before, this was like an hour and a half argument between Michael and I.
That's right. What's that podcast?
This Week in Tech and Tech News Today.
Right. As someone on there put it, Microsoft didn't just sit backpedal. They said, look, we listened. This is what you want. We're going to do it. So they presented it in a very positive way. They said, all right, you don't like it. We're getting rid of it.
And there was some suggestion that maybe Microsoft already had this in the works, and they were like, okay, game publishers.
They just announced it.
Right, but you want us to do this? We're going to go out there, get our head chopped off, and then you'll see what everybody wants.
I don't think it was a Machiavellian plan.
No?
But
okay.
They were trying to appease game developers, no doubt about that. They were making it very game developer friendly, but they went too far overboard. I mean, they don't care. They'd be happy to have it. They don't give a darn. You know, they don't care what restrictions are on, as long as everybody buys their console. But no, they went too far. They got slapped down for it. I still disagree with Sperling. Sperling, I think, tentatively argued that Sony was basically had the same stuff going on, but they weren't making a big deal about it, and they were sort of avoiding talking about it and saying it's not up to us, it's up to the developers of the games. And they were sort of washing their hands of it, whereas Microsoft was proactively saying, we're helping them and we're going to do this.
Right,
which
is true.
I mean, it's not true. Well, it's true that Microsoft was doing that, but it's not true that Sony had any of the new stuff that Microsoft was doing. I think Sony was more consumer friendly. Microsoft is now matching them, and I think it's a smart thing to do.
Well, then let's talk about Warner Brothers for a second, or a minute or two. You know, to the surprise of exactly nobody, Warner Brothers executive Jeff Robinoff has left the studio. He was one third of a notorious bake-off for the top spot at Warner Brothers Entertainment. TV chief Bruce Rosenbloom was also passed over and left earlier this year. In fact, he left for Legendary Entertainment, which is one of Warner Brothers' big, I guess, partners there on film and television. They produced or helped produce and co-finance The Dark Knight and all those Batman movies, so go figure. Robinoff's people claim he was being edged out of key decisions, whereas other execs insist Robinoff simply wasn't accepting his new boss, Kevin Tsujihara. At least Robinoff will be leaving on a high note, thanks to the commercially successful reboot of Superman, capping off a recent run that includes Hangover 3, The Great Gatsby, and 42. An executive reshuffling announced on Monday made it official, with no one replacing Robinoff directly. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. We knew it was coming and it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, well, you know, Robinoff is really good at what he does. Maybe he'll stick around, because I'll tell you, running a studio is no second slouch position. That's not a slouchy position. That's actually, you know, he's doing a heck of a job over there. And, you know, just because he's not the CEO or the chairman, whatever, of Warner Brothers Entertainment, that might have been, hey, we need you where we've got you.
Is it because they did the bake-off? If they had just announced that Kevin is the new boss, boom, would that have saved face?
Yes. This was a horrible idea.
Or really? Because
this was a horrible idea from the start. I mean,
if they just announced, if you thought I'm next in line and then another guy gets it, doesn't that also make you want to leave?
Yes. Well, then, yes, that is correct. That's probably what would have happened.
You don't think they both would have? You think it's possible one or the other might have stayed if it wasn't a bake-off?
Right. Because effectively, the person that wanted your job is still there. You want him gone. So if you're Kevin Tsujihara, you want to start taking control. I mean, and the fact that they're not replacing him actually shows, leads me to believe, well, yeah, he was being left out of decisions and he probably wasn't
happy. It wasn't Kevin embraced the troops and said, hey, you guys are really important, let's make this work. It was like, yeah, I'm the boss now.
Right, precisely. It's like, and as a matter of fact, when you leave, we're not even replacing you because I'm the boss now. So in any case, it'll be interesting to see where Robinoff lands. He's a talented executive.
We'll be raising up funds for him because we want to make sure that poor kid gets by. And we'll be able to do a Kickstarter campaign. So he doesn't have to, you know, jump into a new job. Poor guy. Hollywood exec looking for work.
Yeah, we'll work for movies. In any case, speaking of working for movies, 50 Shades of Grey, remember that porno book? I mean,
not a porn.
Erotica book.
It's erotica.
Erotica, okay. In a savvy, self-inoculating move, or perhaps maybe just a creative choice? In a savvy, self-inoculating move, the film adaptation of 50 Shades of Grey has a director, and it's a woman. Sam Taylor Johnson is best known for her British film about the early days of John Lennon called Nowhere Boy.
Pretty good movie.
Yeah. That may ensure the film will have a guiding sensibility that appeals to the trilogy's legion of fans, you know, most of them women, by the way. Just as importantly, it quiets those who might want to question the film's integrity. Producer Mike DeLuca raved, Sam's unique ability to gracefully showcase complex relationships dealing with love, emotion, and sexual chemistry make her the ideal director to bring Christian and Anastasia's relationship to life. It's an interesting comment since she's made all of one film. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a big potential franchise, so it matters who the director is. It's a lot of attention. It's certainly one of the biggest casting announcements, I think, for a director that I've seen in quite a while. I mean, since it's her husband is Aaron Taylor Johnson, terrific actor. He was one of the actors on Nowhere Boy. That's where they met. Does that mean that he gets to play Christian? They say, no. He's not involved, not in the running, not a package deal. But I don't know. It works for me. He's 23 and the character's 27. So, you know, who knows?
On our short list, we have Brad Pitt, Christian Bale.
No, too old. They're
Johnny
both
Depp.
Old.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't stop anybody from casting the wrong person.
No. You can't cast a guy in his 30s or 40s. That's an entirely different dynamic. He needs to look like a guy in his mid-20s. Otherwise, it's creepy. Then it's an older man with a young college student. That's a totally different vibe from a 27-year-old multi-billionaire.
Yeah,
he's a hot young multi-billionaire, not a creepy middle-aged multi-billionaire.
It makes totally it too different. Real. Yes.
Just ask, what's her name? The Heart Stealer. She'll tell you. Ruby the Heart Stealer.
Well, Netflix inked a programming deal to bring new DreamWorks animation shows to the streaming service.
I'm going to start grumbling already.
Yeah, DreamWorks animation, i.e. Michael's favorite topic. This starts with a series spinoff from the summer animated film Turbo, which looks awful, by the way, about a snail that dreams of competing in the Indy 500. And yes, many outlets just referred to them as DreamWorks and not DreamWorks Animation, which is a completely different company.
Just like Time Warner Cable has nothing to do with Time Warner, we won't make those mistakes again.
That's right. Geez, some people just don't do their homework. But it's not just future TV shows that are in question here. The big piece of the pie is that Netflix gets a key window on the feature films, including current hit The Croods and Turbo. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a programming deal. Everybody wants exclusive content. I get a little worried about it. I don't want to have to know, I want to watch a DreamWorks animation film. I better go to Netflix. I like to have stuff on as many platforms as possible, but I understand windowing, like maybe they get it for a little while exclusively. But anyway, I was annoyed by the article because it was an ad week and they talked about, this is going to help DreamWorks Animation. They need this money to deal with runaway costs. And they mentioned the layoffs and the cutbacks after Rise of the Guardian, as they put it, quote unquote, flopped extravagantly. By the way, Rise of the Guardian costs $145 million. It grossed $306 million worldwide, and then made at least another $100 million in ancillary markets, you know, streaming, DVD, online, all that stuff. Really, $400 million for a budget of $145 million. Not exactly an extravagant flop in my book. It's crazy. DreamWorks Animation released 26 films. 19 of them have been outright smashes. That means 7 films were not outright smashes. They weren't necessarily extravagant flops, but they weren't huge hits. 4 of those happened right away. 4 of the first 7 were flops. That means they were getting their feet and they made Stallion, Spirit of the Cimarron, and a couple other movies like Sinbad that didn't work, but that's when they were finding their way. So since those first 7, they've only had 3 flops, 19 films and only, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, 19 films and 3 of them were not huge smash hits. And one of them, as we just pointed out, was fine. Rise of the Guardians didn't make a ton of money, and they've got franchises. They've got Shrek, Kung Fu Panda, Madagascar, How to Train Your Dragon. Those are toys and merchandise and games and TV shows. That's a lot of money. Basically, they made 26 films. They spent $3 billion on the budget. They grossed $11 billion at the box office on all 26 films. They more than tripled their budget. That doesn't include DVD and TV shows and video on demand and streaming and all that other stuff. That's how unsuccessful DreamWorks Animation has been. Are they really got the tin cup out and they need help to make sure they can pay the bills? It's crazy.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that they went public and they have to show, you know, quarter over quarter growth and year over year growth. And that's kind of hard when you're a content company. That's why they never should have gone public. But that's just, you know, that's just my feeling.
Drives me nuts. So it's a big whoop.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a little bit of inside baseball there at the end.
Oh, true.
Yes. And that is our next segment, in fact, Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And in fact, unlike some of our Inside Baseball segments, this one will really affect you, potentially, maybe.
You think?
Well, I don't know. The trial of Apple versus the Justice Department has come to a close. It came to a close last week. The judge in the case said before closing arguments that the issues of the case had, quote unquote, shifted. And that word shifted was in quotes, somewhat. A clear indication that, yes, judges who express an opinion in non-jury trials still keep an open mind and that Apple has possibly won its case. Now,
yeah, I thought this was fascinating because I was watching the coverage for the several weeks while they've been in trial. And every day I would read stuff and say, the defense scored this point. The prosecution scored this point. And as I'm watching, I'm thinking, I don't get it. I'm watching this and I'm thinking the government doesn't have a very good case. Apple's making a lot of good points. I don't understand. To me, I'm watching it. I'm thinking, well, they're convincing me. I already have had an opinion. But as I'm watching day by day, I'm like, well, I don't know. It seems to me like Apple's making a really good case. Why did the judge say in advance, looks like the government's going to win this? But in fact, the judge has now said, look, I've heard the evidence. I did indicate that, but I have an open mind. And Apple's made its case. It's looking good for them. It's not a slam dunk. But she's clearly indicated it was not a good day for the Department of Justice. She said, basically, that issues have shifted. And she also says, by the way, she loves her iPad. I'm sure they were happy about that. You know, we had the joke about they were displaying slides using an Apple MacBook and it worked great. And then the Justice Department pulled out like their HP laptop and it failed. Now we know the judge has an iPad tablet. They're trying to explain something like the page shifting graphic on the iPad. She's like, oh, no, I know that. I got an iPad. I love it.
Well, now,
so I'm sure that was a great day at the court for them.
Well, what did the government win? Were there any wins there for the government?
Well, you know, as I watched day by day, I thought their little victories in court, you know, cross-examining people and doing all this stuff, I thought they were very minor. There was one where, like, one of the Apple people, the main guy leading the case, was talking about his relationship with one of the people at a publishing house. And the government said you were indebted to him for what he'd done. He's like, well, I don't think I used that word. And they're like, email 74, this draft, you used the word indebted. He's like, well, all right. So he's, you know, he didn't say, I hate the guy and I'm not indebted to him. He just didn't remember that word.
Yeah, and so what that he said it to the guy? I mean, what if the guy went to a different company? He'd still be indebted to that same guy, not the company.
Right. But another thing was that there was a big debate about what Apple's share of the publishing market is. Now, the government expert witnesses said Apple's share is 17 to 20%. Apple says their share is 25%. And they brought in all these people to argue. Oh, no, it's 70 to 20. And Apple says, well, it's more like 25. And the government says, your iBook business has been a disaster. You've admitted it. And Apple says, no, our iBook business is great.
Yeah, that's kind of like the bank robber saying, I should have shot you while I was robbing the bank.
Right, but like 20% versus 25%, who cares? What does this have to do with the case? Again, this was sort of presented by a lot of people as a win for the government because they had quotes from Apple people being disappointed about this aspect or that aspect of the iBook store. But what they're forgetting is the big picture that Apple was launching the tablet, the iPad. This was a category that did not exist. Nobody knew if it would work. It came out. I, for one, like an idiot, said, I don't know. It looks like a big phone. I want one. I instinctively want it. But I'm not sure how important it is. And it turned out to be a massive success story. And one of the things that they wanted at launch, they had music, they had movies, and they wanted books.
Well, Eddie Q wanted books, but that's not Eddie Q wanted books. And Steve Jobs said, you have 4 months to get me books.
They're right. They wanted books, but they did. It was important. I think the fact that the tablet launched with books was very important. They wanted a successful product launch, and they believed, at least some executives, they made it happen, that books needed to be part of that mix at the launch. Yeah, the Apple bookstore looked cool, little books on the shelves. That was part of launching the iPad as a successful product. It's one of the most successful product launches in history. And now, all those e-readers, nobody wants them anymore. They all want tablets. Kindle has a tablet. The Nook has a tablet. They've all gone from being e-readers only to tablets. It's a wild. So when you say Apple's iBook store only has 20% of the market, A, that's a lot of market. B, it also helped them launch the tablet, which is the bigger picture. So, you know, you've got to put it in context.
Well, and I think, you know, you in our conversations, you pointed out that, look, you know, Apple had already used the agency model, which is what they're faulted with using here, when they launched iTunes for music and apps. So it would make perfect sense that they would just kind of follow through and use the agency model with books as well. I mean, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, the government acted like it was a conspiracy. Oh, you only switched to the agency model. And Apple's like, well, we used it for the last several years for all our other businesses. Why wouldn't you use it in this one? So I felt Apple had a lot of success on substantial points. Another one was Barnes & Noble. The government said, look at you, you're pushing for this deal. Turns out Barnes & Noble was pushing for the same type of agency deal that Apple was pushing for even before Apple began negotiating with the publishers. So they say it's a conspiracy between the publishers and Apple, but in fact, before they even began, Barnes & Noble was pushing for the same type of deal.
Well, and, but I thought the whole point was that Apple was colluding with all these different publishers to raise prices.
Exactly. And yet, in trial, we find out Apple is trying to keep prices lower. The publishers wanted to say, well, we can have any price we want. And Apple's like, no, 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 no. You can't go over $15. It'll be a disaster if you go over $15. You can't window, which is what publishers wanted to do. Publishers wanted to treat ebooks like paperbacks and said, you got to wait 6 months or a year to get it on ebook, because then we won't erode the sales of the hardcover. You know, it's very scary when you switch to a new format, when you go from LPs to cassettes or cassettes to CDs, any type of format change, VHS to DVD, it's very scary. They're afraid of killing the market they already have in order to get the new one. So all the publishers said, we've got to have windowing. We've got to do this. We've got to wait on the DVD, on the ebook before we launch it. So 6 months, 9 months, a year, then you can get the paperback and the ebook. Apple said, no, 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 no. They pushed back on that. They said, you got to keep prices lower. Publishers wanted to say, well, we'll try. Let's not put it in stone. Apple says, no, we want a maximum price of $15. So they were pushing back on them to keep prices lower. They were pushing back on them to have windowing. And different publishers were arguing for different things. So the idea they're all working together when they're all fighting with each other and arguing for different stuff and different elements.
And it seems like Apple is actually arguing for the consumer.
Well, no, they were arguing for what they felt was smart for the market. They were arguing for what they felt was important for their business, while HarperCollins was arguing for what they thought was good, and Random House was arguing for what they thought was good. They all thought that they were doing something that would make a profitable business and keep consumers happy, but they just had different opinions. So again, not much of a collusion.
Well, okay, so I guess the government didn't know as much as they thought they did.
Right, when the government said, you're windowing wasn't an issue because only 37 books were windowed. That means only 37 books did major publishers step up and say, we're going to hold back the ebook, 6 months or 9 months or a long time after we release the hardcover. We won't put it out on ebook. It only happened 37 times. And Apple's like, well, but it matters what 37 books they are. If it's the new Harry Potter, if it's the new Dan Brown, that's a big statement, you know? And of course, it's the fact that they threatened to do it and wanted to do it and had pushback that kept them from doing it. They also said, oh, prices went up right after this deal was made. And they were looking like a time frame of literally days. Like they're saying, oh, look, these books went up the day or two after the Apple made this deal. And they went up to $15 from $10 because that was the Amazon price. And Apple's like, well, if you look at like the whole year and you look at a lot of books and not just three or four books, if you don't take a select sample and a select time frame, you can see prices actually went down overall. So, you know, it just seemed like a very weak argument from the government overall. And the more you learned about what Amazon had done, you thought, why didn't they go after Amazon? Amazon was selling books at a loss. Barnes & Noble tried to enter the publishing business. They tried to enter the ebook business. And every time they sold a book, they lost $3.
Right, which they can't do because they don't have like a whole grocery store and department store behind them.
And then when they launched the Nook and it was a hit, suddenly their losses were exploding because everybody was buying a Nook. And they said, oh my God, we need an agency model. We're losing money every minute. And so, you know, they're trying to enter this market, but Amazon's monopoly of over 90% of the market and selling books at a loss kept any other competitor from coming in. So what Apple and the publishers did was end a monopoly. They broke up the monopoly Amazon had in ebooks. And for that, the government sued them.
Well, and that's part of the issue there is because once they ended that monopoly, then the price of ebooks rose from $10 to, you know, between $10 and $15.
Well, they didn't, though, because ebooks allow a lot of people to self-publish. They allow a lot of different price points. You can see bundles of books being, you know, you can't look at like a week or two. There's still a lot of books that are $10, $12, and $10 is a loss. So, I mean, to say that consumers benefit when a product is sold at below cost, and therefore it becomes an unsustainable market for a business, doesn't make any sense.
So let me ask you this.
So I pay $10 for a book. Is that great? Yes, I'd rather pay $10 than $15. But what about 6 months from now when my bookstore is out of business? Is that good for me? Is that good for my community? Is that good for the consumer when every other publishing, you know, bookstore is gone and the only one left is Amazon? Is that to my benefit? No, it's not.
Well, I can see that you don't have strong feelings about this particular story.
No, not at all.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is it that all of the other publishers, or at least two or three of them, have...
They made a business decision. Why did they settle is what you're asking.
Yes.
Me. And they made a business decision that it was cheaper.
Well,
they said, it's cheaper. We don't want to fight it. And they've made a decision. They've only agreed to it for like 2 or 3 years. They've allowed to go back to this different system. They felt like the monopoly was already broken up because Amazon did not have 90% of the market. They were able to get prices up on certain select titles when they felt it was important. Windowing was dead. And I think that they felt that a lot of the market things had already happened. Apple has 20% of the market. The government says you're a failure. That's still a big player. The Nook has been an important part of the market. Kobo in Canada has 60% of the ebook market. So there are other players involved. Amazon is still the 800-pound gorilla, but they're not the only game in town. There's a lot of other things going on. There's a lot more players. And so I think that they felt, you know what, for 2 years, we'll go back to this other model. And then when we're done, we'll be free to do whatever we want again. It's not worth the money and the time. And I think that they have other things that they need and want. They want Random House and Penguin wanted the merger to go through. That's why they settled. They wanted their merger to go through. That's two of the six right there. Well, Random House wasn't involved. But of course, Penguin was involved. Random House was the one that was not involved or that wasn't included in the suit by the government. But they wanted the merger with Penguin. So Penguin said, we're not going to fight it. And then the government approved their merger. So a lot of other factors. And I think it was not a case of believing they would lose in court, but believing that it wasn't worth their money and their time. And that's not a great way to do it. But I love the government summation. They have this libertarian mantra that they said, quote unquote, free markets have a way of working things out, and free markets have a way of serving consumers, which is sort of like saying you don't need regulations. If Amazon is a monopoly, it'll all work out. Don't worry about it.
So then what did you do? You just wasted how many taxpayer dollars to anyway?
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, what's going to change? Like I said, a lot of people have already caved and before going to trial because they feel it's better in their business. It's not going to change much of anything for consumers.
What? That's how I started this whole segment, saying that it might affect consumers, and now you're telling me it's not going to affect consumers at all.
I don't think so, because in 2 years, the deal that they made with the government, the five publishers that settled, those will be over with. Amazon may well triumph, so that's a good thing. But in practice, there's going to be 2 years of no deals like this, and then we'll see prices going up and down. I think that there's a new world where, you know, books will be available as hardcover and paperback and ebook all at the same time. I see that in children's books now a little bit. Where a book comes out, you can buy in hardcover or paperback or ebook the day it comes out. Why make them wait? If you're going to sell ebooks for $9 or $10, why make them wait for the paperback? It doesn't make any sense anymore. So you know what? You got a new book by a new author. Maybe you buy the paperback. Maybe you get the ebook. Or maybe if it's an author you love, you know you want to have a copy on your shelf, maybe you buy the hardcover. That option is up to you. So, you know, I think it's a whole changing world. But one thing that we did see was that Publishers Weekly published an ebook on the case. It was called The Battle of $9.99, How Apple, Amazon, and the Big Six Publishers Changed the Ebook Business Overnight. It was by senior editor Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly. You can buy it at Apple or Amazon for $1.99. It's The Battle of $9.99, and the book costs $1.99. However, I think PW jumped the gun, Publishers Weekly, that is. They put this book on sale last week, just as the judge hinted in her comments that maybe or maybe Apple was going to win after all. And unfortunately, their description of the book says, little did Apple know when it introduced the iPad in 2010 that it would be setting itself up to land in federal court on price-fixing charges. This blow-by-blow account charts how five of America's six largest publishers, afraid that book-selling powerhouse Amazon's $10 price for Kindle ebooks would undermine the industry, spent a few frantic weeks in early 2010 deep in negotiations with Apple to introduce a new business model for ebooks just in time for the launch of the iPad and the iBook store. The catch is, it all may have been illegal. End quote. Unfortunately, the catch is that it all may have been legal. Plus, they were in the same negotiations with Barnes & Noble before Apple even began.
Right. We went,
so the entire premise of their little $2 ebook may be faulty. And instead of waiting for the end of the trial so they could phrase everything properly and put it in proper perspective, they tried to be cutesy and jump the gun and put it out before the decision was made. For what point? I don't get it. It doesn't.
Well,
there's
that's
no
why it's, look, it's only $1.99. So
it's $1.99, and then they'll update it in 3 months when her decision comes out. But to me, the way they pitched it, they should have at least waited till the summary was over, until everybody had their say, because I'm sure they would have reworded it differently. That's the danger of ebooks going out too quickly. But hey, you can always update it and change the text.
Well, now, speaking of things that are over, that's exactly
This week is over, and Sperling is going on a cruise on Disney. Are you going to wear a Mouseketeer hat the whole time?
No, I'm not.
Oh.
Obviously, I'm not going for myself.
All right.
Okay.
Well, Disney cruises are great for the whole family.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
I'm not that they're an advertiser on the show, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, well, I'll let you know. I'll let you know firsthand. But in the meantime, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher, or anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Any place that aggregates podcasts, you can download our show. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show. And we do urge you to subscribe and to rate and review the show on all of those different aggregators. It's also where you'll find ways to contact us. Again, our email is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is our number. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us. We have a Twitter account. That can be found at Showbiz Sandbox, so twitter.com/showbizsandbox, or Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Like us over there. Submit some stories. Let us know what you want us to cover. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. This week, Michael Giltz can be found where?
I'mnotreallynaked.com.
Okay, well, or, you know, try bookfilter.com or
Michael. Yes, please do.
Yes, or michaelgiltz.com if you want to read some of his writing. Some of my writing and work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
Actually, I am nude.